Welcome to a Bowden Education podcast. In this podcast, I have the great pleasure of talking to Joe and Tom Brassington about the importance of creating emotionally safe spaces. Tom is currently a year three teacher and is in his fifth year of teaching. He leads geography, reading for pleasure, and mental health initiatives in his school community. Joe holds a leadership position at his school in Lichfield, and in his fourth year of teaching, Joe is passionate about children's and adults' mental health in education. Together, Tom and Joe have written the book Bottled, which we'll find out a little bit more about later. So welcome, Tom and Joe.
Hello.
Hi.
So let's start at the beginning. Tell me what initially motivated you to teach. Is it you come from a teaching family because, you know, your brothers, you've both gone into teaching at similar times? So what motivated you?
So we don't have particular links to teaching in our family at all. My mum's worked in schools in the past, but not as a teacher. So I don't think it's something that we've seen from the family. For me personally, I think it was what it quite often is for teachers, an adult who taught me, who I was inspired by, and who I spent my lessons with them thinking, that person really cares about me as a student. And that person really wants me to thrive. And that idea that somebody who doesn't really know me and has kind of been put with me randomly cares enough about me to want me to do my best. And so I think for me, that was it. And I was fortunate enough to have a number of teachers, both at primary and secondary level, who were those teachers who saw me for who I was and really encouraged me to do the best that I could. And I really can't think of a better job than that. And so I think for me, that's what inspired me, I think.
My motivation is really similar. I suppose I kind of see this dual motivation where I'm motivated by the brilliant teachers who I had who were inspiring and ignited my kind of love of learning that I still feel now. But I also feel inspiration by some of the times in education where maybe I didn't have the best teacher or I didn't feel as safe or encouraged in a classroom environment. And I suppose I'm motivated by both of those things, to be a great teacher like the fantastic teachers that I had, but also to do a better job in some of the areas of my education where I felt that I needed that.
And you both have subject degrees, so why primary?
I initially wanted to do secondary. I'd kind of got it in my head. So early on, even before going to do my degree, I did a degree in music theatre, and West End stardom was not quite on the cards for me, but I did want to be a secondary school teacher for a long time. And to be honest, I bottled it. That's ironic to use the word bottled. Oh, that's so. But I did. I bottled it completely. I got to the stage where I thought, oh, I'm not sure I can do it. These older kids, they're almost my age, and how's that going to work? And the more time that I spent during training, kind of doing volunteering slots in different schools, the more I saw the absolute joy that primary had to offer. And I found that for me personally, beginning those steps on that educational journey with those children is such a privilege. And I definitely believe that our secondary colleagues have such a privilege as well in that role of continuing that education. But for me, as soon as I'd done primary, I kind of knew that was where I wanted to be.
Yeah. I kind of stumbled upon primary more by mistake. I similarly to Tom, kind of wanted, so my degree was in fine art, and I wanted to pursue that kind of as a career initially. And then I also liked the idea of potentially teaching in secondary schools or even at university level. And in my third year of university, we had to do a work placement, and I left it really late to organise it. And everyone that I lived with at the time, they were all primary school teachers, trained to be primary school teachers. So what a friend said, well, why don't you come and do a work placement in the primary school I'm working in at the moment? So I did, and it was just the best week. It was incredible. And I suppose I realised as well, actually, I was kind of good at it. And I thought, I can get paid just to teach children and have a laugh in a class full of children because here's the thing, I think children are almost always more entertaining to be around than adults. And to spend a week in a primary classroom and just have such a laugh, but also see children get better just within a week. I was so excited by that, that I think at the time Tom was already training, but I applied kind of immediately after that week to become a primary school teacher and start my training after my degree.
So the best procrastination you've ever done, really.
For sure, for sure. And I've done a lot.
But it led you down the right path. So now you're firmly, you know, on your way in your careers now. And I've been on your website, an emotionally honest space.co.uk. I highly recommend it. It's really nicely presented. So I appreciate that. And I expect so with a fine art graduate, but really lovely website to look at. And on your website, you talk about believing in creating emotionally honest spaces in education. And that's your sort of driving force. Talk to me or describe what you believe or understand or what you would like us to understand about what is an emotionally safe space.
So I think what that phrase means to me and Joe is that it's a space that people feel they can communicate with one another in, and that that communication will take place in a safe and respectful way. And I think too often we all experience spaces that aren't safe, spaces that aren't built for collaboration or aren't built for communication that's actually going to develop into something positive. And when you've had those experiences in those negative spaces, you recognize the value in those positive spaces that we can create. And so my personal kind of understanding of what we say about that is that it's a space where we can be kind, when we can be honest, and when we can be respectful. And if we're those three things kind of in a sort of triune, then we're going to have really beneficial relationships, and it's going to be meaningful as well. I think we're all out here navigating life, and especially over the past year, we're navigating life in really tricky times. And those connections that we make with people need to be meaningful. We need to know that those connections are real and really that they are collaborative. And so for me, that's what it's all about.
I completely agree with what Tom's saying about kind of making your classroom as a physical space, a space that is honest and open and encourages conversation. And I suppose the other thing about space is making space as in time. So the children in my class, and I know the children in Tom's class, know that there is time in our day to talk about how they're feeling. There is time in our day to share if they're upset and to have a conversation about why that is and how to move forward. And I think that's really important, particularly in schools that are increasingly busy, which we are. Our school timetable increasingly is, there are limited space for additional things in that timetable. I've been teaching for 4 years and already I've seen that is increasing as we go along. So building space as in time as well, I think is really important, and making sure that your children know that there is that space, there is that time for those honest conversations, and that they will always be encouraged.
Yeah, and I suppose right now, and we've entered a time where children are returning, or more children are returning. Some children have been there all the time, but en masse, children are returning now to school after a significant break, and actually having not had much time in school when we were last back in school. Surely now is the time where these spaces and to feel emotionally safe are so important. Yet as teachers as well, you've got the rhetoric coming down from the DfE around catch up, catch up, catch up. What are your reactions to that, really?
I think what is there to catch up on? We are all living this tricky, tricky situation, and many of us have found it unbearable at times as adults. And for children, I said to my friend at the weekend, children have for a lot of adults been that anchor during this time. Adults have found it really tricky to cope, and children have been the ones who have been consistent and have helped them cope with the change and the loss and kept them going. And I think it's our turn to pay them back and to be there for them. And so in terms of the rhetoric around catch up, it's for me, it's a case of I want to catch up with them. I want to know how they're doing, and I want to make sure that the experiences they've lived through the past year or so are expressed in the classroom if they need to be, and certainly expressed with somebody that they trust, because this whole backdrop of COVID is also sitting with a backdrop in which our children are constantly seeing filtered highlights of people's lives on social media. They're constantly hearing about fake news in the media. And so we need to get back to that core value of honesty that seems to have been lost for a long time. And now more than ever seems like a good time to do that.
I agree that this idea of catching up, the flaw in that is as Tom said, to catch up with what standard are we measuring against? And actually, often we're measuring against a standardized level of learning that anyone who has worked in a school or has a child knows isn't how learning works and isn't how children work or development works. I also think that as well as the rhetoric around catching up, there's also a lot of conversations about kind of re-establishing our school and re-establishing things the way that we had them before children were off. And actually, I think there's a more positive way to look at it. I think this is a really unique opportunity for schools to refresh and to restart and to maybe shift what their priorities are in the classroom. And I think if you can see this time as an opportunity to restart and refresh and make your classroom cultures what you want them to be, that's a much more positive and much more exciting and in the end, much more beneficial way to approach this time than to think about catching up and re-establishing what we had before.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is a moment in time, and if we don't seize it, we'll lose it. And I think it's so important to think about the things that we had to stop because of COVID, but we don't need to carry on. And we're in no worse place from it. And you can look at that from the numbers of meetings that previously you spent time sat in, right through to, you know, SATs, that we're going to have 2 years of children entering secondary school, and they all seem fine from where I'm sitting. You know, having not undertaken their SATs has caused them no problems at all. It might cause other problems in the system for those who want to measure things, mm-hmm. but for the children themselves, they're perfectly fine. We should raise the debate of why we do things at this point. So, and I did actually a SureMind sort of live broadcast the other day, and I was saying, you just give space to children to tell their stories, because they're going to have stories, aren't they? Happy stories, things that they've learned, but also stories of loss and sadness. And have you come across that? Because you've been back now, you know, two whole days, but I'm sure children have come bursting in with their stories in those 2 days.
My reflection on the stories that children have shared with me since returning to school is that some of the lessons that children have learned and the lessons that I think all of us as adults have learned over the last year are around what is important. And I think that what we've learned over the last year, what I hope that we've learned, is that meaningful connections with other people are important. Our time spent working together, learning together is important. Community is important. Our kindness, the way we treat other people, empathy is important. And I suppose that feeds into what I was saying before about refreshing our curriculum, refreshing our culture in school. If we've experienced this year where we've learned that community, kindness and empathy are important, where are they in our curriculum? Where are they in our school culture? And are they as high as maybe they should be?
And yeah. I'd say it's not just noticing the stories that the children are telling. I think it's thinking about that wider school community who's been impacted over the past year. And particularly, I was stood on the playground this morning and I was waiting for my children to come and line up with me. And I was looking, I was thinking, we have hundreds of families in our school. And that's hundreds of families who, for all we know, haven't had that trusted person to talk to over the past 12 months. And I just want to make sure that I'm there for their kids to be able to be that trusted adult. And the same with my colleagues as well. I think particularly about when me and Joe talk about this often, when we were training to be teachers, we were very much told that our job was to get up every day and act the part, to get up in front of that class and you're that smiley, positive person for those children. And I want to be a positive, uplifting person for every child in my class. But I also want them to know that that's not what I'm like all the time. Mm-hmm. And so they don't need to know the inner details of how I'm feeling every day. But I can be honest about how I'm feeling. And I can say, I've woken up feeling a bit grumpy this morning. We're going to have a good day. I'm so glad that I'm here. I'm so glad that you're here. We're going to learn together. But I just want to set off to just let you know where I'm at, in the same way that I want to know where they're at. And I think some teachers shy away from that. Some teachers don't like that as an idea. And I can understand the trepidation, particularly because there's been a narrative about being positive all the time as a teacher. But I think that's problematic. I think we've got to learn, if we're wanting people to share how they're feeling, if we're recognizing the importance of talking about our own mental health, what better place to start than the primary classroom?
Yeah, and you're right in that if you want to create an emotionally safe space, building barriers and constant positivity from you, I'm fine, everything in my world is fine, ties in very much with what Joe was saying about the social media that they see, you know, the polished image of your life. It does then make it harder for you to say, but I'm not feeling that happy, I'm not feeling that positive right now, doesn't it, in if you feel it's against the backdrop of everyone else's.
Absolutely. And Tom and I say all the time that when, as primary educators, one of our key tools is modelling. If we want children to write cursively, then we would model that. If we want them to be able to use fronted adverbials, we would model that to show them how it's done. And if we want children to talk openly and honestly about how they're feeling and to become reflective on that, we're not going to be able to achieve that if all we model to them is perfect positivity all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on now to think about schools more widely, do you think there's a lack of, and you alluded to maybe it should be more prioritised in the curriculum, do you think there's a lack of focus on creating these emotionally safe spaces in schools, either because they're not priority in the curriculum or just because schools don't prioritise them, understand the importance or whatever?
In every school that I've worked in, there are staff that see this as the vital piece of work that they do in their job. So I know that there are teachers and TAs and office staff and all sorts of leaders in schools who think this is the priority. They've got to make sure their children are well, both physically and mentally. But I think the problem that I see is that that then doesn't shift a culture in a school, because one person can't do that. So you've got to have everybody on board, and it's got to be something that is driven forward as vital from the leadership teams and supported by the staff. And I think even from the work that me and Joe have done, we've put some blog posts out on our website and invited people to discuss with us. And we've had some feedback when people have kind of challenged us. And I don't know if you'd want to say something about that, Joe, but I would say that what I've learned from that is that if you value it, you've got to share why you value it with your colleagues, because then they might understand a little bit more and they might be able to see the child that you're concerned about in your class. They might be able to see a counterpart in theirs. And when they can see that, when it becomes something tangible, that child in your class is affected, that's when people's mentality shifts a little bit.
I agree. And I think there's two barriers between teachers and doing this work in schools, two main barriers. The first one is about teachers' lived experience and their own empathy with the impact that mental ill health can have on people and their families and their lives. And for some people, they haven't lived through that. They haven't seen the impact that can have on family members or felt it for themselves. And thankfully, I'm thankful that they haven't. I wouldn't wish it upon them. But unless you have had that or had somebody explain that to you, some teachers don't see the importance of it or the value of it. And I think the second barrier beyond that is that as teachers, our entire view of what education should look like begins with how we experienced education ourselves as children and as young people. And if we all went to school during a time where we didn't talk about our feelings and that was seen as weakness and we were encouraged not to, which is what a lot of people experience. I know certainly that's how I kind of remember high school and primary school being, then that's how teachers perceive education should look, because that's how they experience it themselves. So I suppose to overcome both of those barriers, a key thing that I think is really important is to have that honest conversation with staff about why this work matters and the impact that it can have if children aren't taught to talk openly and honestly about their feelings or even to reflect on them themselves, and where that can lead to as they go beyond primary to high school and into adult life. The statistics speak for themselves. It's frightening. But I think without having that conversation with all staff so that everyone empathizes and is on board with why this kind of work matters, often, not often, that's probably unfair to say, but sometimes you can end up with mental health work being a bolt-on added into the curriculum in a couple of timetable slots, maybe a mental health week in the year, which, you know, Children's Mental Health Week is really important. And me and Tom celebrate it in class and mark it in class with vital conversations, but it's the beginning of a much wider conversation. And it's about, I suppose, getting teachers and staff to empathize with why this work's important and then how we can make it a thread that's weaved through our entire curriculum and our school culture, rather than a bolt-on that we're adding on once a year or a couple of times.
Yeah, those mental health days, mental health weeks are the start of an ongoing conversation, aren't they? They're not the entity in themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger. And I do think as well that you said anyone working in education knows that there's so much pressure on that time in the day that things get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and teachers see, oh, another initiative, oh, we've got to do that now, you know. And we see, and when I work with student teachers, I often ask them, I say, oh, when has anyone seen someone be taken out of an English or a maths lesson for a PE intervention or an art intervention? And they look at me like I'm quite crazy, and they laugh. And I say, but is it such a mad discussion to have? And so then we do open up into a discussion about how that poor child maybe is taken out for English, doing more phonics, out of the one thing maybe they're really good at.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing? And why aren't we valuing then, or we're devaluing other subjects? And exactly the same thing around looking after themselves and developing themselves. Mm-hmm. It can't just be something that we didn't get the maths done, so let's knock it into next week.
Exactly. And I think you're right, that's a huge, when I'm talking about barriers, I suppose, for teachers, the third huge barrier is time. And you're right, it can be really difficult to find time within the curriculum. And I suppose that's where Tom and I, over the last few years, have kind of worked on developing ways where this kind of work doesn't take extra time. So a really big suggestion that Tom and I always make to teachers is to reflect on the lens through which you use your picture books. So every teacher in every primary school will read picture books to their children most days, and particularly lower down in the school, but I encourage it throughout the whole school. I think it's really important. And we will have conversations through those picture books about the grammar that's in the picture books, or about the punctuation, or the way the sentences are structured, and we'll use those as teaching points. But actually, it really doesn't take much more time to have a few questions that allow a child to empathize with the character in the picture book, or to open up a short conversation about how the characters are feeling and why, and how you maybe could be a good friend to that character in that situation. These can be just 2-minute conversations within the English lesson that you're already doing. And I think that it's those kind of short, as well as having time dedicated to wider conversations as a whole class and maybe specific interventions for children that you identify it's important for as well, where are you kind of, I suppose it's like putting on those goggles to be able to see everything else that you're doing in your school through that lens, and where are you making the most of and utilizing those small opportunities to have those conversations?
And picture books are a great tool. Interestingly, our very next webinar coming up on Bowden Education is using picture books across the curriculum. So there you go. But really important. But also, I've often talked about what you have your learning intentions, learning objectives, whichever you choose to call them. And we're so funneled into having maths, so we have maths learning intentions, but why can't you have other cross-curricular learning intentions within a maths lesson or an English lesson or whatever as well? And it is about being clever and embedding.
I think maths is a really great example. I think so many teachers during their maths lessons teach collaboration and empathy and teamwork, because often children are working in pairs or as groups to solve problems, but they don't realize they're doing it, or they don't make it explicit, or they don't make the most of that opportunity. And I think you're absolutely right. It's looking for what other learning is going on beyond the maths or the English intention you've set for that day.
So then talk to me about some things that you've done personally within your own school to really push this agenda of creating your emotionally safe spaces forwards.
I'd continue on, I guess, what Jo's kind of started saying there, in that very much it's how we frame every conversation we have with children. And that does take time to alter your practice as a teacher. But for example, I'm thinking today, I had a couple of children falling out on the playground, one had fallen over and hurt themselves, standard sort of stuff for a primary school. And a few years ago, early on in my career, I would have said, oh, it's okay, let's go and sort you out with first aid and the rest of you go and play, it's fine. I wouldn't have seen the value in taking a bit of time with that conversation. Today, I didn't have lots of time to do anything at that particular point, but I did have enough time to say to the children, I can't talk about this right now because we've got to get on with this lesson, but I really, really do want to sort this with you. And I want to make sure that these problems are resolved. That took me 20 seconds to have that sentence, but that sentence tells those children that they matter to me, and that those children's feelings aren't going to end up at the end of the day spilling out to mum and dad, rather than being resolved in the classroom where I can help because I was there and I can help the situation because I know how to deal with those situations in a kind of like compassionate way. And so I think for me, how I build emotionally honest and safe spaces in my school, it's about how I think about how I'm interacting with children and making sure that they never get the impression from me that I haven't got time for them, or that there's not a space for that feeling in this classroom. Every feeling's welcome. There are ways that we need to learn to express those feelings. And that is sometimes tricky, but you've got to make sure that those children know that no matter what they do, you're there for them. And I think, like we said at the very start of this conversation, if I hadn't have had teachers like that in my childhood, I wouldn't be a teacher now. And I think we've got to allow these children to learn about themselves, discover their own emotions, and really have those conversations so that they feel like they can that they can express themselves.
I completely agree. I think that those conversations are so important. And I suppose there's kind of three themes that run through what I try to do in my class, and I know Tom's the same. There's building language, building the knowledge and the skills, and then the opportunity to practice. So if we want children to be able to talk about their emotions in more of a reflective way, we have to provide them with some language in order to do that. When I was in year six, I wouldn't teach evolution and inheritance without first teaching some really important terms that the children are going to be able to need to discuss that. So we have to build children's emotional vocabulary, and we can do that through our work in picture books. We can do that through our conversations about how we're feeling, through small checkups where every morning the children ask each other how they're feeling, and we talk about words that mean the same or words that have got kind of those shades of meaning. And as we build children's emotional vocabulary, we then kind of have to give them that chance to practice that skill and to build on that. And again, that comes through your conversations around picture books, your conversations around how you're feeling, where you model that to them or you ask children to discuss it. And what you're beginning to do is to widen children's emotional vocabulary and to give them the opportunity to practice reflecting on it. I think when I first started teaching, there was this kind of assumption that I noticed where so many adults assumed that children should be able to talk about how they're feeling or tell you how they're feeling. Maybe a child's get angry on the playground, and so many adults would become frustrated because the child doesn't know why they're angry, or maybe doesn't even know that they are angry. And the thing that Tom and I always talk about is often, particularly in Key Stage 1, but also in Key Stage 2, you have children who don't even physically notice things in their body. So they can be sweating on the playground and not think to take their jumper off because they haven't physically noticed they're hot. Or they can be really thirsty and not even know that's what they're feeling. And if we've got children who can't notice these physical signs in their bodies, how can we expect them to know they're angry and to discuss these really complex emotions that actually a lot of adults find hard to discuss without building some kind of practice? We can't expect them to get there without us working towards that. And I suppose one of the questions that Tom and I get asked a lot and sometimes criticized for is, whose job is that? Is it the job of a school? Is it the job of a teacher to teach children how to discuss their emotions? And I mean, Tom and I have a quite clear view on that. But actually, I think regardless of whether you think it's our job, whether you think it isn't, if we can do that, if we can support children and build it into our curriculum and culture in a way that actually doesn't take that much additional time, but just changes our habits as teachers, then why wouldn't we do that? Because the rewards are immense. Why wouldn't we engage in that work and try to get children to become more emotionally fluent and better at emotionally navigating their lives, I suppose?
And I think you're absolutely right. It's about that sort of changing culture, changing mindset. And actually, if we've got very happy children, if they are free to express their emotions, they'll be engaging more readily with their learning. We know that. So why don't we invest more time? You know, we pump the learning a lot, but we do the same with behavior. We ask children, we say, that's not right, you know, correct behavior, isn't it? And sometimes I think they're in their inner head thinking, I don't know how to behave. So that's not how we walk. That's not how we talk to someone, is it? But inside it's like, I don't know, because I don't see that being modeled to me at home or whatever. But we do the same academically, don't we? I think as well. Write an essay. How do you write an essay? Go and revise. How do you revise? Note take is another one. Who ever taught anyone to take notes? Because everyone assumes someone else did at some point.
And that's exactly it, what you said there about at home. So often the assumption is that this will be happening at home, and this will be conversations that happen in families, but that isn't always the case. And if you work in schools, we know that deep down, we know that isn't always the case. And as teachers and as schools, we have the opportunity to offer what's maybe an alternative blueprint to what the children are seeing at home, or for some children, maybe it's very similar to what they see at home, but we have the opportunity to show that to all of the children. And I think that's really important.
And we do talk about gaps in learning, and this is part of it as well. If we're going to look at equity and closing gaps in society, it's exactly what we need to do. It's the only way it's going to happen. So important. So this leads me on to your book. So you collectively have come together and made a decision to put together your book. Talk me through what sort of spurred you to do that, what you hope to achieve by sharing your ideas and so on, and what the book is about.
Sure. So Bottled is a rhyming picture book that seeks to facilitate conversations with young people about their emotions and about mental health and mental ill health. And really, it spurs from a personal story for us as a family. We grew up very fortunate to not really experience any sort of mental ill health in our immediate family, all the way through our teenage life as well. We were really quite fortunate. And when a close family member did become mentally ill, had mental ill health problems, we were kind of struck without any kind of rope to cling to as a family. And we just hadn't had those emotionally honest conversations before. So when we're adults and we're trying to navigate that for the first time, that was really tricky. And I think for us as a family, we learned a lot about one another and a lot about other people in our lives and their experiences because of what had happened to our family. And after that had happened, me and Joe had an idea for a book prior to that, but it kind of shaped what Bottled has become. Joe, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what the book's about, maybe.
Yeah, so it began really as something for our classrooms. So Tom and I wrote this book to discuss in our classrooms. We use so many picture books to have conversations about emotions in our classrooms. And there are brilliant picture books, so many of them that I could name now and list off, that talk about specific emotions that specific characters are feeling, which is great if you've got a child who's feeling worried or angry or anxious or sad or happy. You can really talk about that using these books. But Tom and I struggled to find a text that more widely talked about this idea of emotional honesty and why it's important to talk about our feelings generally, and no matter what those feelings are. So we wrote a text together that supported that conversation. And initially it was on our notes on our phones, and I would write a bit, Tom would edit it, we'd go back and forth. There was some good bits, there was some really not good bits. It took a while. And we kind of landed on this end text that we were really happy with and started to use it in our classrooms. I went from year two to year six during this time and used the text in year two and in year six. And I had very different conversations with each class, but I had really valuable conversations with each class. So what happened after that is I did some sketches that went with the book and kind of made the text into a physical book with just some hand-drawn, honestly not very good sketches at the time. And we were really enjoying using it in school. I suppose it was, I can't think of the time scale now, I suppose maybe even this time last year, that I tweeted some pictures of this book, just saying this is what Tom and I have created and we're using it in our schools to support these conversations. And we were really overwhelmed by the response to that. We had kind of primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, social workers, mental health experts, people who work for CAMHS kind of commenting, saying this looks like it could be really useful to have these conversations. And off the back of that tweet and the interest that it got, Unbound, who is kind of the leading crowdfunding publisher in the world at the moment, got in touch with us to say, like, we'd like to have a conversation about this book. And that's kind of led us to where we are now. So I don't know if Tom, if you want to talk a little bit about kind of that process of crowdfunding and where we're up to with the book.
Sure. So we were, again, overwhelmed that in about 100 days we crowdfunded our book, which it was not what me and Joe were expecting. We sat down for a meal just before lockdown last year, and I said, I don't know how we're going to raise this money, Joe. I don't have a clue. I don't think anyone's going to back us. I was worried. Joe was was reasonably confident, but we did think it would be a longer time scale. But in January, just before New Year's Eve, I think, we got 100% of our crowdfunding, which is brilliant. And that means now that, one, we can promise that everybody who's pledged already can get a copy of the book. It means that, two, we can make sure that anybody who wants to pledge now can get a copy of the book. And three, it also means that we're able to sort of work with partners up and down the country, both in schools and sort of more outreach projects as well, to be able to create resources to support the book, which it really is beyond our wildest dreams. And yeah, we're really excited about it.
And what's really exciting for me, I think the most exciting part for me, and Tom and I had this conversation at the beginning when we were talking with Unbound as the idea of crowdfund publishing the book, is that we could have got Bottled to become a published book because we thought it was a good idea, and maybe we managed to convince one other person that it was a good idea. But I just think it's really amazing, and I'm always so proud and kind of humbled by the fact that our book is becoming a real book because so many teachers think it's important too, and all these people have got behind the message that the book teaches. That's just really exciting for me.
And so when are you expecting your first drop of the books to come?
That's a big question. I think at the moment we're in the editing process with Unbound. We've sent off a text that we're really happy with, We'll hear whether they're happy with it too. And then Joe, with his fine art background, is illustrating the book. So once we've got the go ahead with that, the illustrations will be done. And I think we're hopeful that it will be later this year, whether it's a little bit into 2022, we're not sure, but we're just so excited that we can make it a reality and that those people who have supported us, we can support their classroom practice now through our book.
And that's great. And you've just got such a lovely story of something you're passionate about, that it's something that's so important in schools, talking about, you know, your emotions and your feelings, and then also thinking, well, let's scaffold it, going back to what we said, scaffold it for other teachers to help, because not everyone's confident in doing this just as them, you know, not all teachers are. We assume sometimes that they would be, but they're not. So to have this book will be a real resource that, you know, can be used. And it will be, we'll put a link to it on Bowden Education, but you can get all the information you need by going to your website, the anemotionallyhonestspace.co.uk. You can get all the information there if you want to pledge and then secure your copy. So we can do that. But thank you so much for taking time this evening. Both really busy first full week back with your classes, and thank you so much. It's been really fascinating, and it's just lovely to speak to teachers that are so passionate about what they do against a backdrop that we hear so often about how challenging teaching is and the negativity around the profession. So it's a joy always to meet people that are so positive. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sticking up for teachers as well. It's really great to have that ally. So thank you.
All your needs to stick together.
Definitely.